Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore, and we are glad you are along here for Thursday. Right on the heels of his election as mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan has proclaimed it's the last political office he will ever hold. That is what I call term limits. Within 24 hours of finding out that he is the next mayor of Detroit, he says this is going to be it. It led to, apparently, his election has led to speculation that he might run for higher office, and he nipped that in the bud yesterday. Some interesting segments for you coming up on the program later on. We hope you will stick around. We'll talk with playwright Carolyn Gage, who's in East Lansing from Maine, and she has devised a workshop that uses role-playing to combat racism. We'll learn more about that directly from Carolyn Gage, who will be in the Current State studios here in just a few minutes. At the top of our program yesterday, Attorney General Bill Schuette unveiled a new 64-page report to address the issue of human trafficking here in Michigan. The report was prepared by the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission, which is a bipartisan group of legislators, law enforcement officials, educators, and other stakeholders that was assembled by Schuette last March to address the issue of modern-day slavery. Joining us by phone to discuss what's in the report and to tell us more about human trafficking is Bridget Carr. She's the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan School of Law and was a member of the commission. Bridget, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Tell us at the top here, what exactly is human trafficking?
Trafficking is when individuals are compelled into service, either in sex trafficking or in labor trafficking. And that compulsion can be by force or fraud or coercion, or for anyone under the age of 18 who is being sold for sex, just their use is the compulsion. So it's really when people are exploited for profit.
Is it more often for sex, or is it more often for the labor?
So the conversation in the media and pop culture is often about sex trafficking. However, we actually identify more labor trafficking cases than we do sex trafficking. But that's really because right now we're still criminalizing victims of sex trafficking. We see them as prostitutes, and so we view them as people who need to be arrested. And so once the work of the commission is implemented and we can really move Michigan's laws to victim-centered laws, I think we'll see more sex trafficking cases.
Is this, I take it, one of the recommendations in your report?
It is. So right now we see in the human trafficking clinic every day how victims of human trafficking are criminalized. So, for example, we know of a 14-year-old who was being sold for sex in Ann Arbor, and when she was found, she wasn't treated as a victim. She was held as a juvenile delinquent because she had cigarettes on her, so she was a minor in possession of tobacco. We represent a woman who was sold and brutally abused for years by a pimp, and she's a witness in a federal prosecution, but she faces a prostitution charge in a Detroit suburb. We represent kids who have been held in domestic servitude in Washtenaw County who were identified by their teachers as victims of child abuse, put in a state system that didn't recognize their unique trafficking needs and really caused them significant harm. So we know that a paradigm shift in Michigan needs to occur, and the commission's recommendations will really allow that to happen.
I think many people imagine foreign nationals as the victims of human trafficking. Are Americans victims to human trafficking as well?
They are. Sadly, there's no way to be immune from human trafficking. And so we see in many of our labor trafficking cases that the victims are often foreign nationals. But in most of our sex trafficking cases, the victims are actually U.S. citizens. You can be a victim of trafficking growing up in your own neighborhood and being sold there. So you don't have to be transported or moved across a state line or an international line to be a victim. It can happen in your community to your community members.
And I take it statistics are pretty hard to come by. The state doesn't keep track, neither does the FBI. Do you have a sense of how pervasive this problem is in Michigan?
So we don't have a sense. I can't give you a number that it happens to X number of people every year. But what I can tell you is that we work on cases throughout the state of Michigan, from large cities to small towns. Labor and sex trafficking is occurring in all of these communities. One thing I often like to say is, point me to a community that doesn't have a problem with illegal drugs, and that might be the community that doesn't have a problem with human trafficking. Human trafficking is more profitable than selling drugs. If I have humans as my commodity, I don't have to replenish them in the same way. I can sell the same person over and over again. And the likelihood that I will get caught is also much lower. If I have 100 pounds of cocaine in my home and someone sees it, they're going to call the police. If I have 100 pounds of a slave, in all likelihood, I'm so good at what I do that no one will even know that she's my slave. And so the risk is very low for me to be caught, but my reward is in a tremendous amount of profit.
It sounds as if human trafficking can be hard to track. Is that generally the case?
It is generally the case that it's hard to track, which is why part of the commission's report is about trying to increase the number of tools that law enforcement has to go after this issue. But it's also hard to track because it's often happening in ways that we don't want to talk about. You know, you can drive down I-94 or on I-96 and see billboards that say, Asian massage parlor open 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. We don't really want to confront what's happening in our communities. That sign is saying that people are being sold for sex, and we're not having those conversations. And so it's going to take some tough conversations in our communities about who's buying services of exploited people and who's profiting from them.
Mm. Bridget Carr is on the line with us this morning. Bridget's the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan School of Law and was a member of the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission, which just released a new 64-page report as to how to address human trafficking in Michigan. This commission was convened by the Attorney General last March, Bill Schuette. What was the process like as to coming up with the 64-page report?
A lot of hard work. I've been asked to be on a number of commissions and task forces, and I have to say, at this one, everyone showed up to the table every month, and then we had meetings, subcommittee meetings aside from that. It took some really hard conversations and some significant compromises. Look, this report is not the report that Bridget Carr, director of the Human Trafficking Clinic, would write. I didn't get everything I wanted, and just like other folks at the table didn't get everything they wanted. But I think what the report reflects is an extremely important collaboration and compromise to put together a comprehensive strategy to fight trafficking in Michigan. And, we should be improving on it in the years ahead, but this is the crucial first step that needs to take place.
Give us an example of something, the recommendation in the report that you really like.
I really like the recommendation in the report that allows victims of human trafficking to vacate convictions if they're a victim of human trafficking. It recognizes that we are not going to identify all victims the first time around and that we are still going to be criminalizing some victims. And so by saying that we have a mechanisms for folks to go back and erase those mistakes, erase those convictions that were made when they were actually victims of trafficking, is an important acknowledgement that we're not going to be perfect at this, but we still have to find a way to protect those victims when we're not perfect at it.
And give us an example of one of the shortcomings in the report.
The federal law says that anyone under the age of 18 who is induced to perform a commercial sex act is a victim of human trafficking. It's a full stop immunity. I had hoped that was the next step that Michigan would take. Instead, the commission compromised on the idea that we would offer a presumption of victimization for individuals under the age of 18 who are being sold for sex. And that presumption goes away if they don't comply with court-ordered services. So, that didn't get us all the way to federal law the way I hoped we would, but it's a huge step, and we're 80% of the way there. And I think that change will put us on the step to full immunity in the years to come.
What got in the way of that, though, Bridget?
I think there are concerns. I think all coming from really good intentions of, if we can't keep these individuals in some type of lockdown facility, they're going to be at risk to be exploited again by their pimps, or they won't get the services they need to recover. I understand the motivation for that kind of thinking. My position simply is, if you are a victim, you are a victim, period. And if you are a victim, nothing you do or say in connection with services should change whether you're a victim or not. And so we're getting there. Look, this is a huge paradigm shift that we're asking states to take on, moving away from criminalizing these folks to treating them as victims. And, you know, I think about the domestic violence movement. We didn't get there in one report. We didn't get there in 1 year. And so we're getting there, and these are really important victim-based steps that we're going to take.
A bunch of your report addresses how to identify victims of human trafficking. What are some of those ways, and how can you train people to better be more vigilant about instances of human trafficking in the community?
Well, I think one of the most important things we can do is start telling people what it is, that it's not exotic, that it's compelled service, and giving them a sense of what to look for. Every time I do a training of whether it's law enforcement or doctors, you know, folks say, oh, yeah, I've seen that, but I never had the label that went with it. It kind of looked like child abuse or kind of looked like domestic violence, but there were these other parts to it, and it didn't fit the narrative I had in my head. So sometimes really educating folks about the label is extremely powerful. The other thing is trying to explain to people the tactics that traffickers use that would make these victims extremely vulnerable. Traffickers are so good that victims are not going to self-identify. This is not, you know, a Lifetime movie where when law enforcement comes in, the victims raise their hands and say, save me. These are complex situations in which traffickers have convinced their victims that they're safer with them than they would be with anyone else. And so, you know, we have to work even harder to help them.
It's not hard to imagine younger victims of human trafficking. Are there many older victims as well?
There are, and sadly, the conversations around trafficking often seem to only focus on younger victims. But I always say, you know what? 14-year-olds turn 16, and 16-year-olds turn 19, and 19-year-olds turn 25. And so, you know, people get older, and often traffickers have identified people when they're younger, groom them to be victims, and then keep exploiting them. And then by the time someone's 22, let's say in a sex trafficking situation, they're 22, they have 7 prostitution convictions, they might be addicted to drugs, and they've been arrested by cops so many times that they're not looking to cops as someone who's going to help them and see them as a victim. So it's really important that we don't stop thinking about victims as victims when they turn 18.
Can someone who's been through this horrific experience, the way you just described it, over a period of quite a few years, how often can people like that successfully reengage with society? I imagine the longer they're a victim, the harder it becomes to reengage, to reconnect with ordinary life.
You're exactly right, and you know that's what's really sad about this is all of those missed opportunities to help that person makes it even harder for them to succeed later when they do get help. You know, but human beings are amazingly resilient. I've seen some of my clients come out of situations of years and years and years of being exploited and have managed to restart their lives. It looks different than their life looked like before they were being exploited. But then I've seen others who are not able to overcome those things. And, you know, I think part of what the commission's report is trying to do is saying we need to look at the types of services and support these types of victims need because they're a little bit different than the other types of people that we're serving right now as victims. And so, look, we're not going to be able to help everyone. Not everyone is going to be able to rebuild their lives, which is a horrible, horrible tragedy. But the reality right now is we first have to stop arresting them. We first have to stop putting them in jail because they definitely can't rebuild their lives from jail.
What happens to the commission's report here now? Do we know the next steps?
Well, everyone's committed, led by Attorney General Schuette, to try to implement these provisions. I know that Representative Heise has committed to working on getting many of the provisions listed or many of the recommendations listed in the report introduced into the legislature. You know, I'll work hard to educate people about what the bills do and why they're important for victims. You know, but at the end of the day, it really rests on the members, the citizens of the state of Michigan, to say this is important to them and to encourage their legislators to pass legislation and encourage local law enforcement and others in their communities to do the types of things recommended in the report. If I had a magic wand that I could make everyone do these things, this issue would have been fixed a long time ago.
Very interesting discussion. Bridget Carr is the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan School of Law. She was a member of the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission, which just released its report yesterday. Bridget, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Every home football Saturday here in East Lansing, thousands of people flock to the Michigan State campus to take part in a sacred fall ritual, tailgating. But the pastime takes a toll. After the celebrating, landscaping personnel at MSU repair damage to grass and trees. Some of those personnel are calling last Saturday's damage the worst they've seen. Last week's rain meant ruts gouged into the ground by cars were especially bad, and sometimes accidentally, sometimes not, tailgaters end up pruning or otherwise damaging trees, important not only for their beauty, but also to classrooms and researchers. It's a challenge not unique to Michigan State. Here to tell us more, we welcome back to the show Dr. Frank Tolewski, MSU Professor of Plant Biology and Curator of Campus's Beale Garden. Hi, Frank.
Good morning, Mark.
Your colleague Sean O'Connor, who is Landscape Services Manager here at MSU, suggested to the state news that this was the most destruction to the grass that he had seen after a football game. Do you tend to agree?
Yes, I would agree. I've been here for, well, it'll be 21 years in January, and we've seen quite a bit of tailgating activities on campus. And this time was particularly bad, and I think given the circumstances of the weather and the conditions, it exasperated that.
Help us understand how much damage is typical.
Well, normally, when the parking is controlled better and we have access to a field like Munfield for parking, the damage is pretty well minimized. I think that in a case like this, we have a situation where the rain caused the closure of Munfield because we didn't want to rut up Munfield.
Right.
And that ends up in a redirection of parking traffic. And again, I think our folks from MSU Police could probably address that situation a little bit better than I can. They're very knowledgeable about the challenges involved with that. But I think the biggest challenge that confronts the collections and the rutting up of the turf and the damage to plants on campus is when people break out and they start cutting ropes that are to protect areas, to start driving up over curbs and parking, or moving bollards. I mean, we've actually had bollards that block sidewalks so you can't drive up a sidewalk, and they actually move them out of the way, and they just kind of get this breakout parking into areas, driving into the turf, and then it's soft. That's why we don't park on Munfield when it rains.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get stuck. They start rutting up the turf, been told, if you want to get in there, gun it, and it's, little statements like that, and it kind of tells you that, maybe we shouldn't be parking on these soft areas at all, let alone when it's raining.
And I take it the normal amount of damage, if there weren't so much rain, for example, on a typical weekend, the normal amount of damage is sustainable. I mean, you have the resources to repair whatever damage is done on a typical weekend.
Yeah, on a typical weekend, there's usually better control over the parking situation. And about 15 years ago, Paul Schwartz, our campus arborist, and I initiated a program, which a lot of people are probably very familiar with, seeing those signs, save our trees, no parking, please. And when I came here in the 90s, parking was pretty rampant on campus and everywhere and anywhere, even up on the Sacred Oval. And we're very concerned as arborists, as tree physiologists, about what kind of damage happens to the below ground conditions for roots. And so working with DPPS, then MSU Police, we put a program together to redirect people away from the sensitive zones.
What's happened to that?
Well, it continues, but now what the problem is, especially when you have a weekend like we just did with the bad weather and the redirection of traffic, people begin to ignore those signs. They pull the signs up. They drive over into areas where they shouldn't be parking. And I said, MSU Police would be better able to address the challenges associated with trying to maintain that sort of a situation that's occurring.
Should there be stricter rules or stricter enforcement of rules for tailgaters?
Personally, I'd like to see that. I'm not sure what the challenges are involved with that, but if somebody has cut a rope or moved a ballard and is parked on turf and is running it up or under tree roots, or if somebody's cutting trees so they can get their tent in there. We had this a situation with a donor on campus actually pruning a tree that they needed to get their tent in, or people who are tying winches around the trees and girdling them, trying to pull their car out of the mud. There should be consequences for that. I mean, if I drive fast on campus, I will get a ticket. I will expect to get a ticket. If I park in a no parking area, I will get a ticket. I expect to get a ticket. It may not be making the customer happy, but there are also rules and regulations, I think, that hopefully can, you know, be more properly enforced.
I suppose you stand to tee off a lot of people who've planned a gathering and then who learn that the spot that they had targeted isn't available. That, I mean, doesn't that stand to create some kind of PR problem for the university?
We've actually dealt with that. We dealt with that 15 years ago when we started the whole No Parking Please, Save Our Trees campaign. Paul Schwartz and I would come onto campus on a football Saturday. We were cussed at. We had beer thrown at us. We were called tree huggers. But we very politely and professionally explained to people that, you know, MSU, I love thy shadows. Beneath the pine trees we'll gather, that this is part of being MSU Green. This is a part of sustainability, too, if you think about it. I mean, our environment, we talk a lot about sustainability in terms of recycling and energy conservation. Sustainability is also maintaining the sustainability of the environment and our conditions and the health of our plants.
We're talking with Dr. Frank Tulewski of Michigan State University about damage done to the campus via tailgating. How much tree damage? We talked about the grass damage, which is easy to visualize on a soggy mun field, but how much tree damage is done on a typical Saturday?
On a typical Saturday, we don't see too much. There is the occasional damage that does take place. It seems to me that this weekend, probably related or not to the weather, there was more damage. We had a crabapple tree that was girdled, as I mentioned earlier, because somebody winching their way out of the mud. We had some branches and trees damaged. I think people get enthusiastic and excited maybe about the win or maybe about the loss. We were very lucky in the Beale Botanical Garden. A lot of times after a game, people come through and break up plant labels or something like that. Unfortunately, we didn't have any of that damage this particular weekend, and maybe because it was raining, because people maybe after the game decided to head out almost immediately thereafter.
Is it more accidental, or are there more cases of malicious destruction?
That's hard to say. I would probably think most of it would be willful destruction. I think in the case of, you know, girdling a tree to winch your car out, that's inadvertent. Maybe the person didn't think about the damage to the tree that we're going to do. But when you have somebody coming up and pruning a tree so they can get their tent set up better, or to tie something off to a branch and have that branch break off, or climb into a tree and break a branch, that's just really not, you know, really thinking very well about the stewardship of the campus.
Are there trees on campus that are a part of research that arguably should be fenced off?
That's a good question. We do have a number of researchers here at Michigan State across a number of departments, entomology, plant biology, horticulture, forestry, that are using our plant collections in active research, sponsored projects in excess of $1 million, grants on some of those projects. Fortunately, we haven't sustained any damage in that area. And yeah, that's something we may have to think about, is that it does look like they're going to be threatened, and maybe we need to do something more to protect those. Fortunately, that hasn't been an issue yet.
We did talk about the possibility of having Sean O'Connor join you for this segment, but it turns out Sean is having a conversation this morning with officials at the University of Michigan about this very topic. So it just clarifies the fact that Michigan State is not unique in this respect when you get tens of thousands of people coming onto campus to tailgate.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I wish that Sean could be here, because Sean could speak much more to the landscape situation. I'm a professor. I'm concerned with the curatorial activities of the collections on campus and the research. Sean's more involved in the maintenance and day-to-day activity. And really a shout-out to the landscape services crews that come in here on a Sunday to make the campus look beautiful on a Monday morning. If people saw what the campus looked on a Sunday, they'd be shocked. I think they'd really be flabbergasted about how much damage and how much litter there is accumulated.
You were involved in another very interesting development involving a crime in West Michigan. You joined us here on Current State earlier this year to talk about that. This involved work that you and your team did on the soil and plants found on the shoes of a suspected murderer in West Michigan. Can you briefly update us on what has happened on that front?
Yes, back in September, the state attorney general and the police department up in the Ludington area partook in a press release, an announcement of charges of open murder being filed against the father of baby Kate in the matter, and that this will be progressing to trial in the not too distant future. I'm sure that I and my colleagues will probably be called to testify, but this is something that is moving forward. The field investigation phase of it is pretty well wrapped up, and they're ready to move forward.
And you helped analyze some of the plant material that was on the suspect's shoes, which actually ended up becoming a link in the case.
That is correct. And we actually, this last summer, got another one of our colleagues here, Jan Stevens, who's a diatom specialist, to actually do some further research. So again, the study progressed since we last talked, and we have a lot more information than we had, and I think that's something that the law enforcement officials are very excited about.
Dr. Frank Tulewski is an MSU professor of plant biology and curator of MSU's Beale Gardens. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Mark, thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. The holidays are approaching, which for many means sharing great food and gifts and catching up with friends and extended family. For some, it also means time, that time once a year when you have to be subjected to that racist relative's offensive rants about this celebrity or that group of people. Well, our next guest might be able to help. Carolyn Gage is a playwright, director, performer, and activist based in Maine. She's in East Lansing today to discuss playwriting as part of the MSU Center for Poetry's Fall Writing Series, but she's also putting on an interactive workshop today called Interrupting Racism, and she's here in our studio to tell us more. Welcome to East Lansing, or welcome back, as it turns out.
Thank you.
You've been to East Lansing before, from Maine.
Yes.
We don't get a whole lot of traffic from Maine to East Lansing, but nice to have a Mainer here. Your workshop is entitled Interrupting Racism. Tell us about how that works.
Well, I think that a lot of us, have good politics, but suddenly we're in the middle of a situation and a professor or a beloved relative or somebody we thought knew better tells a joke, or a boss, somebody in the workplace, it just, something comes out, there's some horrifying expression or the N-word, and we're just stunned. We're stunned, and the moment moves on, because it's usually not about that. And we're like, and then you lie in bed at night and review it, and you think, I could have. But I think that for the majority of us, when we're blindsided by those, I think most of us, most of the time, let it go. And my background's theater, I devised a workshop where we actually role play those situations. We practice what it sounds like to stop it, to interrupt it, to register our discomfort, so that when that moment comes up, you've practiced. You've been to a whole workshop, and I teach a technique that has steps, and you're like, oh, okay, and here we go, So I think that... that you need to rehearse, so you're ready
just
when it
like
happens.
Just like a good actor or actress would rehearse.
Yeah.
What kind of scenarios do you recreate here then?
Well, a lot of times I'll ask people, and they'll say, my Uncle Frank, he always does such and such. Or sometimes it's homophobia. I call it interrupting racism, but it's adaptable to anything. So people will tell me situations in their families that they've put up with for years. Or sometimes things in the media, like recently there was a celebrity who, was planning a large event with a theme that was antebellum and was going to kind of hire a wait staff to impersonate enslaved people, like, yeah, what a good idea. And in that case, there was tremendous financial consequences. And when I was reading about that in the news, I thought, you know.
This is Paula Deen?
Yes.
Okay.
But I thought, how many family members over the years have been aware there was some kind of insensitivity or lack of education around certain issues and had just let those things go?
Oh, yeah.
Because you think, oh, I'm not going to ruin Thanksgiving dinner. Or, oh, God, that's just her. That's the way she is. But, you know, when you look at it, it would have been better if they'd done that because she kind of lost an empire over it. And it didn't come from nowhere. There were probably dozens, if not hundreds of people over the years who were aware that she perhaps needed some consciousness raising.
Right.
So, I mean, I try to encourage people, go ahead and do it. You know, just go ahead because you're really doing the person a favor, you know.
And for some, I mean, talk about the proverbial racist uncle who's never going to change. I mean, people must say, why bother?
Well, there's several reasons, and I think part of it is that Paula Deen thing. The next time that uncle does it, he might be doing it in a workplace and lose his job. So better to hear it at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, from a relative than have the boss say, I'm sorry, but I got to let you go. So there's that. But also, you don't do it to change the other person. You do it to hear yourself. You do it to just address it. The room full of people heard it, and the voice countering it needs to be heard. When you do it, it's almost always disruptive, of course, and that makes people socially uncomfortable. You may not change that person's prejudice, but they might think twice before they tell that joke again. And that is no small thing. If you change the behavior but you don't change their mind, that's a win. You know?
Give us an example of something, some way you would respond if you're in this situation.
If I was in the situation and, you know, you were going on and on about they've just hired a new Martian on staff and, you know, an obvious prejudice against people and from Mars is coming up, I would say, stop, wait. That's the first step. Get the foot in the door. Wait.
Interrupt.
Wait. And then I'm going to claim the authority, which is I'm uncomfortable. I'm not going to call you racist because then we're going to argue whether I am the world authority on what is or isn't racist. So I don't go there. I'm like, wait, I'm uncomfortable with what you just said. You can't argue with that because you don't know what makes me comfortable or not.
Right.
Wait, I'm uncomfortable with what you just said. Then I get consensus. Now, you just said that you were offended that the Martian working has antenna that they don't strap down and hide. And you would say, yeah, you know, and your point is. And I would say, well, that's uncomfortable for me because that Martians have antenna and that's the deal. And why should they look like they don't come from ours? And I would express my opinion or whatever. And then depending on who you are, I would ask for accountability. I'm going to need to report you to your supervisor or I need you to walk that back or whatever. So that's a little bit. Now, that's just a really brief example. Confronting prejudice is a complicated process. That's why I do a whole workshop around it. But in a nutshell, it's a little bit like that.
Carolyn Gage is our guest. She's a playwright who is in East Lansing and is putting on an interactive workshop today called Interrupting Racism, and she's telling us how it works. When you do the workshops, how do people tend to respond?
They get very engaged because we have all done it, and we all have the boss, the uncle, the, you know, whatever, sometimes a partner. I find it really lively. Usually when you're doing anti-racism workshops, you're preaching to the choir. Uncle Frank with the problem isn't going to be in that workshop. So this is just real hands-on how you do it, you know.
What surprises people who participate in the workshop? Is there any light,
I think
light
the biggest surprise is that you're not trying to change the other person. It's a great relief, and I think they didn't expect that. As I say, you are speaking up for your own integrity. So that the allies in the room can say it's homophobia at Thanksgiving. Somebody makes the joke, you know, using the F word, and you interrupt it, you confront it. You don't know who's in the closet around that table, but now they know you're safe. They heard it, and they're like, I think I can come out to that guy.
Yeah.
You know, so you'd never know the impact. And a lot of people come up later, and they go, so glad you did that. You're like, yeah, where were you? But, you know, but not everybody
it takes
can do it.
Courage. It takes courage.
And they might be the next person because they saw you do it. You know, they heard how it sounded, you know.
Yeah.
So
there is this gap, though, between what might happen in the workshop and the reality when you're actually sitting there.
I really impress upon people. If you call out your boss on in something racially insensitive in front of the workforce, you may lose your job. Yeah. Or he comes after you. I mean, or she. I mean, I think that you can't. There are consequences. There's no question about it. That's why we all sit there in silence. And everybody has to weigh, is it worth it? Am I up for it today? And I just give people the tools to encourage them. If you are up for it, go for it, you know? Do it.
How many years have you been conducting the workshops?
I started doing it about 15 years ago, but I have really been doing a lot of them recently. Maybe just feels like the time. I don't know.
And how did you come on to this idea? How did this take shape?
I'm a playwright. I know how it's like being a dialogue coach, you know? And maybe just because my dad was a lawyer, I know how the argument, you start with that, hey, that's racist. And I'm like, that whole thing's going to derail into what makes you the international authority on what's racist. And then they're going to go, well, I've got friends of color and they think that joke's hilarious. You know, you're going to go somewhere you don't want to go. That's not the point of the confrontation. So I guess because I'm a playwright, that scene is going to go off the rails. I can see it right there. You don't want to head down there. So I know what works and what doesn't. And, yeah, it's a scene. You're in a scene and you're interrupting a scene. And I feel like it's like being a dialogue coach.
You're not just a playwright and a director, though. You also perform.
Yes,
as
I
well.
Do.
Talk to us about that dimension as opposed to the directing and the playwriting.
No. Well, I tour in my own work a lot, and I did some of my work here at the Center for Poetry event last night, where I was performing Calamity Jane, and I was performing, there's a Maine hunting guide from the 19th century that I was performing. I do mostly lesbian-themed work because that's my identity and that is the work that interests me. I write about historical figures whose lesbianism has traditionally kind of been under the radar. I kind of dig that up and bring it front and center. So that's what I do.
And you are busy going around the country conducting workshops?
I tour a lot. I'm based in Maine, and recently I've been more and more focusing on producing and performing my work in New England, because flying has changed. Flying is not what it used to be.
How often have you used some of the techniques in your workshop, in your own life?
I use it all the time, partly because I'm lesbian, and I'm a lesbian cultural worker, so people look to me to be the person in the room who's going to speak up. And so I often am having to address misconceptions or statements that are insensitive or just presuming that everybody in the world is, heterosexual. And I'm having it like, well, you know, that's not always true. There could be two mothers, you know, not necessarily a mother and a father. You know, so I often am that person, the point person for addressing homophobia.
Your interactive workshop is called Interrupting Racism. There is one scheduled this afternoon?
It is. It's 3 o'clock in Snyder C201.
Very good. Carolyn Gage is a playwright and activist based in Maine. She's here in East Lansing as part of the MSU Center for Poetry's Fall Writing Series. Her interactive workshop, Interrupting Racism, today, 3 p.m., Snyder Hall, open to the public. Carolyn, welcome back and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, in our last conversation, we discussed how to handle the individual racism we experience on a daily basis, but what about when it's an industry perpetuating racial stereotypes? Mass media is often criticized for its lack of diversity and stereotypical portrayals. However, Shilpa DeVay, assistant professor in American Studies and Media Studies at the University of Virginia, says those criticisms often stem from a binary, that is, black and white, view of race in America, leaving out important parts of the U.S. cultural landscape, such as Asian Americans. Shilpa, who is also author of the book Indian Accents, Brown Voice and Racial Performance in American Television and Film, explains to Current State's Emmanuel Berry that when Asian Americans are portrayed on TV or film, they are frequently cast as the model minority.
Oftentimes when we see Asian and Asian Americans, they're usually put into a category where they're called, for example, a model minority. So that's looking at Asians in respect to other minority cultures. But even when you say the idea of model minority, what does that say about other minorities? So you're you're creating a hierarchy that's establishing Asians as a particular kind of model for other minorities. But again, according to whom? And that in the whole racial hierarchy is usually according to dominant culture. So I think what you see when you look at media representations is the play of that hierarchy in visual terms or in narrative terms or even in vocal terms. How do people look at what is whiteness and what is blackness? And it's not necessarily skin color. It's the creation of several different kinds of cultural characteristics that come into play. And so in my book, one of the ones that I talk about is how vocal accents become a way of racializing different groups, and in specifically racializing South Asians and Indian Americans, who have traditionally been very difficult to pinpoint in sort of racial hierarchies.
Can you give some examples of what are kind of the typical roles that we see Asian Americans play in cinema and on TV?
There are several different ways of thinking about how do minorities insert themselves into dominant narrative. And there are several different scholars who've talked about this. But the idea is that first, minorities are invisible, that you don't see them at all. Second, that they come into comic narratives. In other words, that they are made fun of and often are the butt of the joke. Third, you start to see minorities in positions of authority that uphold the status quo. For example, judges or cops. And then finally, you get to this point where there's a diversity of characters so that you see variations of all different sorts of characters. For Asian Americans, a lot of them are in comedy. And comedy is interesting because, yes, it's funny, but then we also have to think about what humor does. And humor often diffuses tense situations. And so when you can laugh about racial discrimination or gender discrimination or any other kind of prejudice, it diffuses the tension around it. And I think that's why we see a lot of minorities that are in comedy. And it diffuses tension, particularly for the dominant group.
Getting to comedy a little bit, I think with Asian Americans and what your book talks a lot about is the role that accents kind of play in comedy featuring Asian Americans. So these accents, they are for humor in some ways, but beyond the humor, I guess, how do they define Asian Americans within the U.S. media landscape?
Mostly to define Asian Americans as foreign, as not American. I think when you look at different racial ethnic groups, there are certain ones that are considered to be part of the American landscape, that you do not question their nationality. But by continually emphasizing the accent as a cultural trait, what these narratives are doing is continually emphasizing the fact that Asians will never be American, that they are always foreign. Instead of expanding the definition of what we think of as American by having Asian American, Latino American, and sort of the a wide diversity of people who can encompass the idea of what American means.
I think a good example of that, The Simpsons, which has been on forever, is Apu. He is othered in that sense because of his accent.
Yeah, and I think Apu is an interesting character because the show has been on for almost 25 years now, and so it's gone through multiple generations. And in one sense, Apu, when he first came on, was a revolutionary character because it was the first time that we were really seeing a prominent, you know, Indian animated character. I think what the issue becomes is that any time there is a particular episode that's centered around Apu, he becomes a stand-in for all minorities. And they exaggerate his Indian qualities to the nth degree.
Good rice, good curry, good gande, let's hurry.
Now, of course, The Simpsons is a satire, and so that's what the comedy is going to be about. But I think the episodes that focus on him as an Indian, you know, stereotype him as an engineer or computer science who's now running a quickie mart, or the man who has, you know, eight children, or, you know, the man who has an arranged marriage, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of which are sort of cultural characteristics associated with Indians. In the episodes where he's just one of the guys, he's actually quite great. And so I think that's sort of what you want to think of with the writers is there a happy medium where you can talk about your racial background, your ethnic background, but not exaggerate it so that it becomes this stereotype that is continually repeated over and over again.
Although there aren't many Asian Americans that are necessarily leading roles in film in particular, there has been a larger number of Asian actors taking on different roles. An example of that would be the latest Star Trek film. We had John Cho, who kind of varied from the stereotype a little bit.
Yeah, and I think part of that is, you know, that's derived from the television show Star Trek, where George Takei was the original Sulu. And so in one sense, they are replacing, you know, one Asian American with another Asian American, which is great. You know, John Cho's Korean American. But he is able to be in a show where he is one of the major players. And also in this last Star Trek movie, he was shown as the captain.
Attention, John Harrison. This is Captain Hikaru Sulu of the USS Enterprise. A shuttle of highly trained officers is on its way to your location. If you do not surrender to them immediately, I will unleash...
He also becomes an action hero, too. He's able to go down and fight. He's able to make command decisions. And so we're seeing as an important player. He's still not the leader. It's always going to be Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
But he's definitely there.
We have also seen more Asian Americans on TV. Fox has a lineup. They have the show New Girl and The Mindy Project both feature characters who are American Indian or mixed race in the case of Cece on New Girl. Mm-hmm. How do the stereotypes portrayed in media differ for Asian women than, say, Asian men?
That's actually a really good question because a lot of the research that and a lot of the roles that have been out there have been mostly for men. And so we haven't seen as many for Asian American women and leading roles. And part of this has to do with the stereotypes that we've seen of Asian women who are sort of hypersexualized in Hollywood and television history. And so what Cece and what Mindy are doing is they're really creating sort of the everyday kind of Asian American woman and some of the issues that they might face. Again, in a comedy. And I guess the great thing about Mindy Kaling is not only is she headlining her show, and she's, you know, the second Asian American woman to do so. Margaret Cho was the first back in the 90s. But she also has a lot of creative and production control over the message that she's sending. And part of this is Mindy Kaling's extensive experience in television, screenwriting, and also television shows. And so what this shows is that, you know, she's aware of being Indian, and she talks about that in her show, but that's not the only defining aspect of the show.
Okay, cool. You always correct me when I sound racist.
I don't correct you, and you didn't sound racist.
And yeah, we're lame, we're Hindu, we use Groupon for burritos, but you know what? That's our lot in life, and we love it, so why don't you just leave the Lahiris alone, and to burrito time.
Boom.
She's, you know, the central character, and she talks about being Indian, and she brings in, she's brought in her Indian brother, and she brings it into the conversation, but it's not her only defining characteristic. And that's sort of the really interesting move that she's making, and that some of the newer actors and actresses are doing, is that your race and ethnicity is part of your everyday reality, but it is not the point of focus for every particular narrative.
I think you've already gotten into it a little bit with that last question, but what needs to be done to change, grow, and diversify the portrayal of Asian Americans in media, whether that's the number or the types of roles that are available or that people are seeing?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's great to have more Asian Americans and a diversity of characters on all different kinds of shows. I'd like to see not just comedies, but more Asian Americans in dramas. And so I'd like to see more dramas where the women have and the men have different kinds of roles. But the real key factor to this is also getting Asian Americans to be more productive in terms of their screenwriting, making more movies, and getting Asian Americans in all different aspects of the industry. And there are a lot of Asian Americans in the industry, but they're not necessarily the ones who are putting the narratives out of there. So I'd love to see more writers, more directors, more producers who can say there are these different kinds of narratives that are out there. That's the Hollywood and the television industry, and in the independent movies, there are a lot of Asian Americans. And in the online community, there are a multitude of Asian Americans who are putting out their own products, too, on YouTube and in other ways. So I think part of it is getting the message out there so that it's not just niche communities who are seeing all these different kinds of Asian American narratives, but also making it part of the popular narrative, too.
Shilpa, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Shilpa Devay is the author of Indian Accents, Brown Voice, and Racial Performance in American Television and Film. She also serves as an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia's College of Arts and Sciences. She'll be speaking at MSU on Friday as part of the Asian Invasion Myth Symposium.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, State Representative from the 71st District, Teresa Abbott. Also, we preview the MSU men's basketball season. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. AR.